candor defined as the quality of being open and transparent. On Tuesday, solicitor to the RHI inquiry, David Schofield, told the inquiry that it would have to decide whether an Arlene Foster Assembly statement at the height of the Green Energy Scheme scandal showed the candor which might have been expected. Candor, the quality of being open and transparent. Mrs. Foster addressed the Assembly in December 2016 as the political row over Cash for Aish intensified. It followed the explosive interview given to me by the former party colleague of Arlene Foster, Jonathan Bell. In it, he claimed some in the DUP had worked to keep the scheme open as he tried to close it, allowing hundreds of applicants to pile in and qualify for lucrative payments. That was denied by some in the DUP. Let's hear what Mr. Schofield told the inquiry on Tuesday. Here he is discussing Arlene Foster's Assembly statement in 2016.
So you'll see, Chairman, that the line taken in the statement was that no minister, including the First Minister, gave any direction to Minister Bell, and nor did the DUP party officers formally. And on the basis of those facts, Mrs. Foster says that any person making representations to Minister Bell was not, in Mrs. Foster's words, doing it with the authority of the party. And in light of that, you can see how Dr. Crawford might feel, as we heard on Friday in some of the text exchanges that we looked at then, that he had been hung out to dry by this statement because he, on his own case, is making representations to Mr. Cairns. But it seems from this statement that there is a disavowal that that was being done with the authority of the party. And, of course, the same might also, of course, apply to Mr. Johnson if he was involved in the way in which Mr. Cairns has asserted, which is one of the issues which the panel will have to decide. But one of the interesting things is that you'll see that none of their involvement, particularly Dr. Crawford's involvement, is touched upon in any detail in the First Minister's statement. Rather, the line that's adopted at this point is that the timing of the introduction of cost controls was entirely a matter for Mr. Bell. Now, whilst that might be correct, of course, as a matter of law, as a matter of ministerial responsibility, the panel might wish to take a view, having heard all of the evidence, whether or not this statement displayed the candour which could be expected in the circumstances. Now, of course, there was at this stage, as you know, very significant political wrangling at this time surrounding the RHI issue. You might also want to reflect on whether that was conducive to or antithetical to candour, and also whether that should have made any difference or not. So that discussion really flowed from the text message which Dr. McCormick was sending on the evening of the Nolan interviews and the approach that he felt should be taken at that stage. We also know, Chairman, that Dr. McCormick wasn't the only person sending texts on the night of the Nolan interviews.
Mr. Schofield, just before you move on from this, can I just check that I've recorded this correctly from the statement that you've just gone through from Minister Foster? It says explicitly nothing came from a minister and nothing came from a party official with the blessing of the party.
Nothing came from the party officers, which I think is quite a precise term, yes. Which is a particular meaning.
And any reference to the SPADs has no such clarity about none of the SPADs asked for or influenced that. It's quite specific to no minister did it and no party officer did it. But it's not addressing specifically the point about SPADs who wouldn't fall into either of those categories. Is that correct?
I think that's right. I mean, plainly when Minister Foster or former Minister Foster gives evidence again, she'll be able to explain in more detail precisely what she meant by the words or considered them to mean. But on an initial reading, It seems that she's dealing with ministers who weren't involved, with the formal party officers who weren't involved, but saying very little, if anything, about special advisers, except potentially two things. Number one, special advisers, and indeed no one from the party, overruled the minister after he'd taken the decision. I think that's probably consistent with the evidence that we've seen. But the one thing which might possibly touch on the special advisers is that portion of the statement which we looked at, which says that whatever representations were made on this issue were not made with the authority of the party. So quick query whether that covers representations made by other DUP special advisers. As I've said, that might be why Mr. Crawford, as we saw in one of the text exchanges we looked at last week, didn't seem to be very happy with what had been said in the statement and felt that it led to him being exposed in some way.
So that's what we're going to actually hear what Arlene Foster told you all. And I think this is the important part. This was Arlene Foster standing up at the height of this crisis and telling all of you in the chamber what her position was. And as the inquiry concluded there, she did not, of course, rule out special advisers being involved, something which they all deny, by the way. Remember that she was speaking in the chamber to only DUP MLAs because all of the other Assembly members had left in protest. You might remember that. So let's now hear, you've heard the context of what the inquiry is looking at. Let's now hear some of what Arlene Foster stood up and told the chamber and all of you in Northern Ireland.
The decision was solely for the Deputy Minister to take. The former Deputy Minister claims that he made a decision to amend the RHI scheme, but that he was overruled by special advisers. Since last week, I have specifically investigated this claim. The evidence is clear. The only decision taken by the Minister was in early September to amend the scheme in November. The Minister was not subsequently overruled by special advisers, and I am clear that whatever representations may have been made by anyone on this issue, it was not being done with the authority of the party. Now, I understand from Minister Hamilton that the Permanent Secretary recalls being told at the time that some in the party wanted the scheme kept open. He was unaware of the source of this suggestion, but believes it may have been based on the erroneous but widespread view at the time that because the scheme was AMI-funded, that it was possible to maximise take-up without creating a problem. I have checked and confirmed that no minister made any such request or took any interest in the decision taken in September 2015. The DUP party officers took no interest in this issue and gave no instructions. It is therefore clear that whatever the belief, the DUP did not ask the Deputy Minister to extend the scheme. I also understand that when the suggestion of a four-week extension was mentioned in the Deputy Issues meeting on the 24th of August, the Deputy Minister did not voice any objections. In fact, he endorsed the decision. The bottom line is that this decision was taken by the Deputy Minister, and no attempt was made to overrule him, and no such allegation was made at the time. In fairness to the Deputy Minister, I should say that I also understand from Minister Hamilton that departmental officials did not object to a four-week extension.
Well, let's speak to the newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride. Good morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So when we look back to that, and this is what the inquiry are going to be looking at, and to be fair to all parties, you know, there's more to come, and we keep on encouraging you to, not you, Sam, everyone else, including you and myself, to watch the RHI inquiry, watch the totality of the evidence. But if we drill into this, Sam, essentially you had Arlene Foster standing up. At this stage, it was widely known, both throughout the DUP and indeed within the media, that there was at least a suggestion that Andrew Crawford, her trusted special advisor for many, many years, might have been involved. And we're hearing that unfold in the inquiry now, and it's something that Dr. Crawford emphatically denies. But there was a suggestion. So what Arlene Foster does, Sam, is she stands up, and in this carefully worded speech, she rules out party officers being involved in any way. She rules out ministers being involved in any way. But as Dr. McLean from the inquiry noticed, she does not rule out special advisers being involved.
And that was the thing which immediately jumped out to me. I recall being on your programme, I think it was the day after that speech, and that was the thing which just leapt off the page. She was categorical about ministers, she was categorical about party officers, she went through various categories of people. But then she seemed to leave open the door to the idea that somebody within the DUP had tried to delay cost controls, but she was being very, very clear, saying they were not acting under any sort of instruction. Now, at that time, I think my instinct was that perhaps that was referring to Timothy Kearns, who was the special advisor to Jonathan Bell at that point. We now know that that's not who it was really referring to. He has given evidence to the inquiry where he accepts that he did try to delay cost controls, but says that was because he was being asked by other people within the party to do that. They, of course, deny that. But I think fundamentally, while this might seem quite complex when you play those two clips, this is actually pretty straightforward, and it's about whether Arlene Foster was being upfront with the public about what she knew in a statement where she was, I suppose, giving the impression that this was her really putting the record straight, putting her side of the story across after what Jonathan Bell had said. And she, of course, put, as we heard in that clip, quite a lot of emphasis into the detail of her investigation, as she described it, into what Jonathan Bell had said. I think the question here, which the inquiry is looking into and will be looking into in much more detail, is just how much did she know? How much was beneath the surface of the water in terms of the iceberg here? And how much did she say to the public in comparison to what she didn't say to the public?
Because by this stage, we do know that Andrew McCormick, now I know we're throwing a lot of names out that are familiar to us and not familiar with the public, okay? But Andrew McCormick is a senior civil servant. He was the permanent secretary. When you hear about the permanent secretary being referred to in this speech, that's Andrew McCormick, who was the permanent secretary for Detty at that time, Sam, right?
That's right.
And Andrew McCormick thought at that stage that Andrew Crawford had an involvement in attempting to delay the cost controls coming in. Again, something that Dr. Crawford denies, and let's see what the inquiry concludes. So you have Andrew Crawford thinking it. You have this being spread throughout the media, throughout journalists. You know, I spoke to people at that time from within the DUP who were talking about Andrew Crawford. And yet Arlene Foster doesn't mention at all, when she stands up in front of the public, the prospect that special advisers might have been involved. Now, here's the counter to it, Sam. If she didn't know for sure, then actually what's wrong with her not mentioning it at all? Because you don't bring media attention to someone unless you're sure, in her defence.
That is one aspect of this, and what we know now from the evidence which the inquiry has in writing from some of these people is that Andrew McCormick does emphasise that this was something that he was aware of, but he wasn't certain of. He didn't have direct experience of this, but he had heard about this at the time, and subsequently, what Arlene Foster said in her speech there was that while there was this suggestion that somebody was involved from the DUP's from their side of things in trying to delay cost controls, that Andrew McCormick was unaware of the source. And I think that's something which the inquiry will probably want to scrutinise in quite a lot of detail, because unaware of the source might suggest to the public that really he had no idea who it was. Actually, what we now see from some of the private text and email exchanges was that Andrew McCormick was using the name of Andrew Crawford, Arlene Foster's former special advisor, to Arlene Foster's current special advisor, if there aren't too many names here, who was actually drafting her speech. So the person who she had asked to draft the speech, which she gave to the Assembly, was being told in very explicit terms by Andrew McCormick that actually he was aware of the name. So
Hold on. Because what the draft speech actually said, and I know we're getting into detail here, but I hope the public appreciates that what we are trying to do is go into the details so that we're being fair to all parties. The person who you're referring to who drafted the speech is Richard Bullock. Richard Bullock was at the heart of the DUP for many, many years. You know, both Richard Bullock and Timothy Johnson, for example, were some of the most senior people, advisors in the DUP. So you're talking about Richard Bullock here, okay? What Richard drafted, which Arlene Foster then went on to read, was the following. he was unaware of the source of this suggestion. So the suggestion being that some in the party wanted the scheme kept open. So obviously, Sam, Andrew Crawford knew who had told him, but he, Andrew McCormick, but he didn't know. This is Richard Bullock's version. He didn't know the source of the suggestion.
I see. Well, I mean, I think the wider issue here, I suppose, and the inquiry through David Schofield QC and the clip you played at the start there, is that really what they're examining here, what they're going to examine, is whether Arlene Foster displayed the candour which could be expected in the circumstances. Now, that's subtly different to, I suppose, just saying, was she entirely candid? Was she entirely upfront with the public? There's an element of subjectivity to that. There's an element of politics to that. Do we expect political leaders, when they stand up and make these sorts of speeches, to be entirely frank, to tell us everything they know? Or is it actually reasonable for them to not put out something which is going to, I suppose, harm or undermine their case, as long as what they're doing is not dishonest or is not in any way misrepresenting the facts? So it is something which I think is going to be keenly contested in the inquiry. We're going to hear from all these people in terms of oral evidence are going to be pressed about this. But fundamentally, I think there will be a lot of emphasis put on the contrast between what Arlene Foster told the Assembly and what we are seeing last week and this week in terms of some of these text and email exchanges between some of the senior figures here as to what was being batted around behind closed doors.
Do you know one of the key questions, Sam? Sometimes it comes down to this being really simple. Did any of them phone Andrew Crawford and say, listen, were you involved? Did you do this? And I think you might find the answer to that very interesting indeed. Did any of them actually phone him and say, look, your name's been bandied about here. Did you do this?
The other aspect of this, which is quite important, is that we now know as well from the last week of the inquiry that Andrew Crawford privately was furious about Arlene Foster's speech. He thought that it hung him out to dry. So even though she, in terms of what the First Minister said to the Assembly, the impression to many of the public might have been that really she was saying that Jonathan Bell was talking nonsense and really there was nothing much to see here. To those in the know within the DUP and to Andrew Crawford himself, who of course knows Arlene Foster very well over a very long period, he was very concerned about what she had said. So there are layers of complexity, I suppose, to what Arlene Foster did here.
So I'm going to let everyone hear the Arlene Foster, some of what she told the chamber again. And remember, and look, you know, Sam and I have been over this many, many times. So I get it that we're firing this all at you pretty quickly, which is why I want to play this again. OK, but so remember, by this stage, OK, in this RHI political bombshell, by this stage, the suggestion that Andrew Crawford had delayed the cost controls, it was a rumour. It was being widely discussed in political circles. It was being widely discussed within the DUP. Jonathan Bell had named him, of course, by this stage as well in the Nolan interview that we played on BBC One that night. Emphasise again something that Dr. Crawford denies. But just listen again as to how this carefully crafted, and that is no criticism, that's what political parties do, that's why they have speechwriters. But listen again to how the then First Minister stands up and she talks about party officers. Andrew Crawford isn't a party officer. She talks about ministers. Andrew Crawford isn't a minister. And listen to how special advisers, they just don't come into it.
The decision was solely for the Deputy Minister to take. The former Deputy Minister claims that he made a decision to amend the RHI scheme, but that he was overruled by special advisers. Since last week, I have specifically investigated this claim. The evidence is clear. The only decision taken by the Minister was in early September to amend the scheme in November. The Minister was not subsequently overruled by special advisers, and I am clear that whatever representations may have been made by anyone on this issue, it was not being done with the authority of the party. Now, I understand from Minister Hamilton that the Permanent Secretary recalls being told at the time that some in the party wanted the scheme kept open. He was unaware of the source of this suggestion, but believes it may have been based on the erroneous but widespread view at the time that because the scheme was AMI-funded, that it was possible to maximise take-up without creating a problem. I have checked and confirmed that no minister made any such request or took any interest in the decision taken in September 2015. The DUP party officers took no interest in this issue and gave no instructions. It is therefore clear that, whatever the belief, the DUP did not ask the Deputy Minister to extend the scheme.
So, that last bit, Sam. I've checked this, confirmed that no minister made any such request or took any interest in the decision taken in September 2015. The party officers took no interest in this issue and gave no instructions. And then Mrs. Foster says, it is therefore clear that, whatever the belief, the DUP did not ask the Deputy Minister to extend the scheme. So the DUP didn't do it, the party officers didn't do it, the Minister didn't do it. No reference to this bad, Sam.
That's right. And I think the uncomfortable aspect of this for Arlene Foster here is that it makes public, in terms of what's coming out of the inquiry, what she did know. The public get to contrast that with what she told them. And I think, I mean, to be fair to Arlene Foster, I think that it would be the case that for many political leaders, if we were to see what didn't go into speeches of this sort, we might find similar things. That's not to cast aspersions on anybody, but I think there is a real politique about this, that will a political leader who is at this point really fighting for her political life, will she put out something which isn't going to help her case? Perhaps not. But I think the consequences, potentially, of an inquiry which might find that she did know more than she actually told the public are politically sensitive. There's almost a twin track to this. There's the inquiry process, which is entirely factual, which is apolitical, which is just trying to get to the truth of what happened here. And then there are political implications for a lot of these people. And those two things sometimes coincide, but I think from a political point of view, this is potentially a very uncomfortable aspect of the inquiry's work for Arlene Foster and for the DUP.
Another email exchange was examined by the inquiry this week. It was an exchange between Mrs. Foster's special advisor, Richard Bullock, and the executive then press secretary, David Gordon. He's the former editor of The Nolan Show, by the way, who was advising on the unfolding RHI scandal. Let's have a listen.
I wanted to take you just to one last communication in this theme that we've been looking at of subsequent communications or exchanges, looking back on what had happened in the summer of 2015, which may or may not shed some light on what had been happening then. So finally, just in this vein, on the 28th of December 2016, Mr. Bullock was sent an email by Mr. David Gordon. We find that at IND 60534. As I've mentioned, he was at this stage the Northern Ireland Executive Press Secretary, and he was giving advice about how to deal with the unfolding situation. And the email again appears to be discussing the question of whether Andrew McCormick should give an interview in light, again, of the still being discussed potential release of the recordings of his conversations with Jonathan Bell, which we looked at earlier. And in the course of that email, Mr. Gordon says, just towards the bottom of the screen, an Andrew McCormick statement and even interview before then could preempt some of this, although it does mean dealing with the real story of how cost controls were delayed in 2015 and the political input into that, AC, etc. In an ideal world, you would get the AC story out and deal with this and dealt with this week and spike the BBC and Bell guns. Easier said than done, I know. So having seen that email, obviously the inquiry was extremely keen to find out from both Mr. Gordon and Mr. Bullock what the real story was to which reference had been made. So both have accordingly been required to and have provided written witness statements in relation to this. The common view of both, however, is that the real story referred to there was actually simply referring to Andrew McCormick's version of events, which both Mr. Bullock and Mr. Gordon say that they themselves weren't in a position either to verify or dispute directly, given that they weren't involved at the time. Dr. McCormick's version of events, as we know, was that it was Andrew Crawford who was the source of political influence, as he understood it, in relation to the delay in the introduction of cost controls at that time.
So, Sam, within that, quite a lot within that, but within that, you have David Gordon. Now, he's the executive's press secretary, so he's across quite a lot of what's going on because he's trying to manage the media fallout from it. And he says within that, ideally, you would get the Andrew Crawford story out. So he believes there's an Andrew Crawford story.
That's right, and that doesn't seem to be in any sort of dispute. The question is what that story is and what the veracity of that story was. What, as you heard there, Richard Bullock and David Gordon have told the inquiry is that really, as far as they were concerned, the real story was just the fact that Andrew McCormick, the senior civil servant, was going to say this if he was asked about it. It wasn't that they knew it to be true or anything of that nature, but that was something which the inquiry was obviously asking them. Did you know more to what was going on here than what came out? And really, what we're seeing here is, I suppose,
Do you read anything into them calling it the real story, to Mr. Gordon, David Gordon, calling it the real story?
I mean, it's difficult to tell just seeing that in isolation. We will see a written statement from David Gordon and from Richard Bullock at a later point. It's not clear whether they will be called as witnesses to come before the inquiry, but we'll see exactly how they phrase their explanation for what that meant. But I think that From one perspective, David Gordon here, as the press secretary, as the executive's chief spin doctor, really, who's trying to smooth over this in the media to a certain extent. There's a very large part of it's being dealt with by the DUP as a party, but there's an element of it which impacts on the executive. This is really crisis management. This is trying to realise that there is a very damaging, or certainly a potentially very damaging story which might come out at some future point. And he seems to be advising the DUP, or he seems to be advising the person who's getting this email, that really it's in their interest to really just get this out of the way. So get it out there quickly rather than let this fester and let it run on and run on and run on and come out at some later point and be very damaging. What we know happened, of course, is that it didn't come out quickly. It came out to the middle of January, which is about two or three weeks after this email. And that was when Andrew McCormick was asked about this at the Public Accounts Committee. And he said what he said about Andrew Crawford. 2 days later, Andrew Crawford resigned.
So if we think now about the timeline of what we've discussed so far, and again, I'm trying to step through this slowly because there is a lot in this, right? But if you just even think about this, so we now see through what's been revealed by Sir Patrick Coughlin's RHI inquiry, he's the chair of the inquiry, we now see that there are these discussions at the very, very heart of this, right? You've got the executive's press secretary saying, look, get the Andrew Crawford story out. Get it out there. You have discussions between Andrew McCormick about Andrew Crawford. This is all before Arlene Foster stands up and speaks to the chamber and the public. Andrew Crawford's name is everywhere through this. Mr. Gordon at one stage talks about spiking the BBC's guns, okay? And then when Arlene Foster, the then First Minister, stands up, guess who she doesn't refer to in any way? Not only does she not refer to Andrew Crawford, she doesn't refer to anything that could be linked to Andrew Crawford. In other words, she leaves Spads out of it completely. So you see how he's at the heart of the discussion, and then his whole category of employment is left out of what Arlene says publicly. But again, Sam, to be fair to her, if she knew, and it would be hard to think how she wouldn't have heard about the suggestion, something that he emphatically denies, that Andrew Crawford was involved, maybe because they weren't sure, they were trying to protect him. And what's wrong with that?
That is potentially one explanation for this. There certainly seems to have been a degree of uncertainty as to what had gone on here. One obvious thing which you might do, as you suggested, earlier, is pick up the phone to Andrew Crawford or to call him into your office and say, well, what on earth went on here? It may be that did happen and that he was very clear that really he had not been involved in any way, which has been his very consistent story throughout this whole thing.
I'll say it again. When that speech was being written, was a phone call made or was there any contact with Andrew Crawford to say, look, were you involved? And I think the answer would be very interesting. Carry on, Sam.
The significance of what we see here is that this is coming not from somebody within the DUP who might be a rival or an enemy of Andrew Crawford. It's not coming from a political rival outside the party. It's not coming from some anonymous member of the public. This suggestion is coming from Andrew McCormick, who is one of the most senior civil servants at Stormont. These are people who typically, and we see this very clearly in the inquiry, typically don't rock the boat too much when it comes to party politics. It's not their field. They don't tend to get involved in it. They try to stay out of it. Andrew McCormick would have known the significance of what he was saying, and he was being very, very clear with the DUP that he had heard that it was Andrew Crawford, Arlene Foster's former special advisor, who had played a role in delaying cost controls.
And of course, that's denied. Yeah, sorry, Sam. Andrew McCormick, I said this the other day, but to say it again, he was and still is one of the most senior civil servants in Stormont, just for the context of the public understanding this, so on the night of the interviews, when I went up to Stormont Castle to interview Arlene Foster, that was a pre-recorded interview before it then went out that same night on BBC One. When I went up there, I was escorted to along a corridor to where Andrew McCormick was there, and I was rather shocked to see Andrew McCormick there, because Andrew McCormick is a civil servant, and I was interviewing, you know, the First Minister. I was interviewing the DUP, and what had happened was Andrew McCormick was there, presumably at the behest of his minister, because the minister gives Andrew McCormick the instructions, and I was Andrew McCormick, an individual asked Andrew McCormick to confirm the veracity of some of the answers that the DUP had given me. Now, he was not allowed to speak freely about anything. This was restricted to the specific details that Andrew McCormick was being asked to confirm. So you start to get a picture of how Andrew McCormick, even on that night of the Arlene Foster interview, was certainly seen to be a senior figure whose word and integrity was being presented as being important. And I think that's fair to provide that context, Sam.
Well, I think that shows, as you say, that it was known to those at the very heart of this that Andrew Crawford was a critical figure to finding the truth about what happened here, and to the public being persuaded that what was being told to them was the truth. He is not. He was involved in the delay of cost controls. He has accepted that he made mistakes there, that his department made mistakes there. So he does not have, I suppose, entirely clean hands, if you like, in this issue. But he is one of the most independent figures, I suppose, in the context of all of those who were involved, in that he is outside the party system, and he's somebody who, as you've said, does have a pretty considerable degree of respect at Stormont across various parties. So it was known at that point that he was hugely significant. The question is, I suppose, what was he saying privately to these people? Some of that we're getting to see now.
And by the way, David Gordon's messages were late December, not pre-speech. They were actually after the speech. It's been heard also, let's have a look next. It's been heard about a text message sent by Dr. Andrew McCormick, I think you were referring to these, Sam, to the DUP special advisors just after the Nolan Chew interview with the First Minister was broadcast. And this is December 2016. Let's have a listen to what the inquiry says.
We see here that there's a text message which is sent to John Robinson, Richard Bullock and Timothy Johnston shortly before 11:30 on that evening. That's the 15th of December 2016. And these are text messages which have been provided by Dr. McCormick. So he, either watching or shortly after watching the interviews is texting a number of the special advisers.
Well, this is the same evening as the Nolan interview, is it?
Yes, Chair. And you'll recall that both Mr Bell's interview and an interview with Mrs Foster were broadcast on the same evening.
I'm sorry,
you'll see.
Both interviews were
broadcast on the same evening?
Yes, they were, yes. Sorry.
So you'll see, this is just the third text from the top from Mr McCormick to Messrs Robinson, Bullock and Johnson, same text. And he says it's difficult to understand why she said she had no idea why the 1st of October became the 4th of November. When I've said I would have to tell the PAC, that's the Public Accounts Committee, that TC, Timothy Cairns, and JB, Jonathan Bell, told me that others in the party wanted it kept open. And then we'll see in due course that Mr Bullock and Mr Robinson replied to a further text from Mr McCormick that night. He went on to say that Chris Stewart had telephoned him with a very different version of the conversation, which we understand to be the conversation Jonathan Bell had described in his interview as Mr Stewart coming to him as a whistleblower in relation to the alteration of a ministerial submission in February 2016. So there's a response to that, but none of the special advisers appear to have responded to Dr McCormick's earlier text.
How would you sum this up, Sam?
I think what that shows is that Andrew McCormick's first instinct as he saw Arlene Foster's interview with you following Jonathan Bell's interview that night was that he was querying something that Arlene Foster had said, and he was saying it's difficult to understand why she's saying she's no idea or she had no idea why there had been a delay. He's talking about the delay in cost controls from the 1st of October to the 4th of November. When I have said I would have to tell the PAC, that's the Public Accounts Committee, that Timothy Cairns, that was the then special advisor in the department, and Jonathan Bell told me that others in the party wanted it kept open. So he's really saying, why is Arlene Foster saying this publicly when I've already said to you that I'm going to have to say this if somebody gets in touch? And that's really around other people in the DUP allegedly getting involved to delay cost controls. And this is something which he sends to three of the key DUP special advisers. He then forwards it the next morning, I think, to David Gordon and says, I've sent this to the special advisers. So it's something which is on his mind. And that is the immediate impact, the immediate reaction which he has when he sees Arlene Foster giving her interview to you that night on television.
And just to emphasise again, finally, Sam, that there is emphatic denials that any of the people mentioned in this programme this morning, there are emphatic denials from them that they attempted to keep the cost controls open in any way, shape or form.
That's right. And also, I mean, to be fair, I suppose, to Andrew McCormick, and also, I suppose, to a certain degree, this adds weight to his credibility. The text messages which the inquiry weren't read to the inquiry last week, but which have been published by them, show that night, prior to the text which we've just talked about, where he's talking about Arlene Foster, obviously, chronologically, you had interviewed Jonathan Bell first, and then you went to interview Arlene Foster. During the Jonathan Bell interview, it seems, he sent a text message to two of the DUP special advisers where he's saying that it's very misleading in terms of something which Jonathan Bell had said. And that, I suppose, shows that he is querying both accounts, but he is certainly asking a very difficult question, which the inquiry will come to look at properly in the oral evidence of these people, of Arlene Foster.
OK. Sam McBride, thank you. And I think what we have promised you we will do is, while it is heavy stuff, the RHI story was so big in this society that we do want to now bring you the detail that the RHI inquiry is uncovering. And please go and look at the BBC Northern Ireland News website to see the totality of what's going on with that inquiry, or indeed the RHI website, where you can actually view everything that's going on. RHIinquiry.org, from memory, is the website address. And we will be covering more RHI more RHI material in depth as it comes to us.